5 billion people died in 1996 and 1997. Almost the entire population of the world. Only about 1% of us survived.
Are you going to save us, Mr. Cole?
How can I save you? This already happened. I can't save you. Nobody can. I am simply trying to gather information to help the people in the present trace the path of the virus.
Hello and welcome to the Dead Letter Movie Podcast. This is episode 126, recorded July 6th, 2025. I'm Tim.
I'm Andrew.
We are continuing our Back in Summertime series with a Terry Gilliam movie from 1995, 12 Monkeys.
12 Monkeys. Cannot believe this movie is 30 years old.
That's weird to me, yeah.
It is. So this is inspired by a Chris Marker film called Le Jeté, which is a French film. And so before we get into story time for this movie, we wanted to kind of talk about Le Jeté for a second. It is only a half hour long. Mm-hmm. It is not incredibly difficult to find actually out there. If you go to the Criterion channel, it has two versions of it that you can watch, one in English and one in French. And actually, it doesn't matter which one you prefer to watch, or because the director preferred you to watch what language you're familiar with the most. So
yeah,
Yeah, I did watch both of them just to see what would happen, and they are slightly different. It's more of more of an exercise in translation, you know, than anything else. But
sure.
Story-wise, it's very similar to 12 Monkeys. It's about a guy who's from the future, and in the future there's been an apocalypse, like a mm-hmm. World War III nuclear kind of situation.
Yeah.
And people from the past maybe you could explain how they go to people from the future go to the past in some kind of brain way, right?
Yeah. It's deliberately kind of fuzzy on exactly how that works. There's mm-hmm. there's some sort of technological thing, but there are maybe also some pharmaceuticals. And maybe it's about having the ability to focus on memory. So
yeah.
there are lots of things that could be part of this. The guy has some wires that are, you know, taped to bits of foam that cover his eyes. This reminded me of a novel by Jack Finney called Time and Again,
right?
In which, and I honestly, I've lost track at this point, may have mentioned already on the show.
I think you did.
But in that story, the means of time travel is a sort of self hypnosis.
Mm-hmm.
So you know, a person is shut into a room where there's very little, and you know, is dressed in period garb, and outside that window it looks pretty much exactly like it did at some point in the past. And by mm-hmm. convincing himself that in fact it is that time, he's able to at some point realize, oh, I am there, and walk out the door, and it is in the 19th century. So mm-hmm. so there may be some of that going on here in Le Jeté as well. Le Jeté predates the book by a few years.
Mm-hmm.
So I wonder if that was an inspiration for the author, if he had seen the film.
But I guess also Marker isn't that concerned about the mechanics of time travel. It's just
not really, no. Like yeah. there's a scientist who's sort of directing the project, sort of.
Mm.
We don't get a whole lot about him. It's not really his story.
Yeah. The traveler, I don't think he had a name. He's just mm-mm. the traveler. The traveler does seem to have a special, he at least has a really solid memory, a solid image of a woman's face that he's able to focus on.
Mm-hmm.
So that does seem to be part of the magic sauce to get him to follow through with things there.
Yeah.
But that's kind of where 12 Monkeys is sort of looking at it, or is sort of taking its inspiration, is that, you know, Bruce Willis goes back in time and meets this woman played by Madeline Stowe a few times. And that's kind of like what's being talked about here. The cool thing about Le Jeté is that it's all told in stills. There's only one shot for just a few seconds there
where it's actually you know, moving picture.
Yeah. But it's pretty interesting. I did the French one is interesting. But the one I liked about the English version was I really like the English voice is like very kind of like creepy, kind of haunting, the narrator for that one. And I liked that. That added a different thing. And maybe in the French one it was being a creepy voice and I'm just too American to tell. But I don't know. I've watched a lot of French movies. I think I could tell, but I don't, maybe not. Worth checking out. But yeah, did you think it was worth watching before this? Or no, you watched this after. So
I
like,
actually did end up watching it after, but it's definitely an interesting pairing. I think, most people, if they were putting together the bill for it, would play Lajetée first and then 12 Monkeys. I for whatever reason, I did not watch them in that order myself.
That's well, I mean, neither did I. So no, I did well. I mean, I had seen 12 Monkeys years and years and years before. So like this time I sat down and watched like the two versions of it. And then I watched the David Bowie video Jump, They Say, which borrows elements from the Jetée as well. And so like I had a nice little fun piece of programming. But anyway, let's get into 12 Monkeys. All right. So for story time here, we're going to use the back of the box from the 1996 VHS, which my sister, I believe, owned. And is how I first saw this movie. So it was in either 96 or 97. When did you first see this, actually, before we read
Oh,
that?
cripes. It's been a while. It was maybe 2010, 2011. I'm not sure.
That was when I last saw it, I'm pretty sure. It was around that
Yeah,
time.
it was quite some time after. This was not a new movie by any means at that point. So,
All right. But yeah, back of the box.
all right, here we go. Between sanity and madness, fantasy and reality, the past and the future, comes an adventure beyond imagination. Bruce Willis, Madeline Stowe, and Brad Pitt star in this brilliant sci-fi masterpiece from Terry Gilliam, the acclaimed director of The Fisher King. Cole Willis arrives at a mental hospital claiming to be a time traveler from the year 2035. His mission, to save humanity from a killer virus that will devastate the future world population. A beautiful psychiatrist, Stowe, initially classifies Cole as delusional, but she soon joins him in an adventure that will take them to the limits of human comprehension. As they race to unravel the secret of the 12 monkeys, their paths cross with a one card short of a full deck mental patient, Pitt, and a renowned scientist, Christopher Plummer. Before long, Cole begins to question his own sanity in a chaotic world that offers many questions but few answers. With unforgettable performances and imaginative special effects, 12 Monkeys is a modern-day classic laced with Gilliam's trademark wit and dazzling style.
All right, and just to show how things change in a year, in 1997 they put out a widescreen version of this on video, and they altered the copy slightly. So here, and I'll try not to totally read everything that gets repeated, but here we go. So a lone time traveler from the year 2035 must solve a riddle that may save his people, but it may also take him to the brink of madness. Bruce Willis, Madeline Stone, Brad Pitt star in this brilliant sci-fi masterpiece from Terry Gilliam. Yeah, that's the same. All right. After the world's population is devastated by a killer virus, survivors must live in dank underground communities. Cole Williams volunteers, quote unquote, quotes here, to travel into the past to obtain a pure virus sample, thereby helping scientists develop a cure. Along the way, he crosses paths with a beautiful psychiatrist, Stowe, there's that again, and a one card short of a full deck mental patient, Brad Pitt. And that's more or less, and that's the same. So, and Cole is on the search for the army of the 12 monkeys, a radical group linked to the deadly disease. And then the last paragraph is the same. So, yeah, just slightly different, but it kind of tells you between the two of them, you actually get a better version of the story, in my opinion.
Yeah, I agree. The second one is nearer the mark
Near the
without
mark.
giving too much away.
Yeah, I think it's and well, and before we were recording, we had both talked about how the trailers for this kind of like the trailer didn't work for you. We neither of us rewatched the trailer, so we're literally going off of 30-year-old memories here.
So my memory is that the trailer suggested, I mean, yes, dark and weird, but also more violent, maybe a little more action oriented. Like I liked that it didn't give away too much, like some trailers do. It's like, oh yeah, there's
Especially
the whole
then, yeah.
movie in, in condensed form. This was very much not that, but it also seemed to suggest a different movie than this actually was to me. And again, that's 30 years on. I don't know if I would feel the same about that now.
Yeah, and that same for me. All I remember was And I'm trying to remember. I don't think I saw the theater trailer for this, like in the theater. I think I saw mostly TV spots,
Yeah.
maybe. And all I remember is that this looks dark and weird, and Brad Pitt looks like he's being very strange. And that was like, I don't even remember Bruce Willis being a factor. I mean, sure he was. I mean, I remember this being a Bruce Willis movie, obviously, but yeah, that was something. Just now realized that I just remember Brad Pitt, which would have made sense. They would have really tried to capitalize on him in
They would.
1995.
Yes.
So, yeah, fascinating. Anyway, but yeah, I just remember dark and weird, which this movie is, in fact, dark and weird. But yes,
Very much so.
not very
Just,
action oriented.
dark and weird in ways other than I would have suspected.
Yes, indeed. All right, let's let the good times roll.
All right.
We have a very advanced program, something very different.
An opportunity to reduce your sentence considerably.
And possibly play an important role in returning the human race to the surface of the Earth.
We want tough-minded people.
So, things that work. Back the
Yeah.
box says unforgettable performances. I agree. This is
Totally.
a
Yeah.
standout performance for Brad Pitt out of everything he's ever done, because it's not really like anything else he's ever done.
Yeah, this is his first Oscar nomination was for this movie.
Yeah,
So,
he's really,
yeah.
really good in this, and he's not just, the handsome Brad Pitt, is pithy and maybe punches some guys kind of character.
Yeah, this would have been just after Interview with the Vampire and Legends of the Fall, which were like the
Yeah.
Brad Pitt making movies. I mean,
Sure,
he had been
sure.
in other movies before, obviously. But those were the movies that made Brad Pitt, Brad Pitt. And then I think Seven was this same year, would have been just a little bit before this came out. So like Brad Pitt was like a big deal at this point. And so they got kind of lucky that we were able to get him when they got him. And but he signed on to this because he kind of wanted to do something different.
Boy, did
And
he.
different he did. And he definitely did the work from what I understand. It sounds like he actually checked himself into mental institutions and went to like group meetings and stuff to like kind of get the idea. I mean, I think it's a little exaggerated to a certain extent, but there is some
Yeah, don't try
verisimilitude
this
to
at
his
home, kids.
performance. Yeah, and the eye thing was up to him. Like he wanted the contact lens to just kind of add to it. Might be a little extra, but it does add something to the performance, I have to
Yeah,
admit.
to reference a later film in the Ocean's 13, it's not a prop for prop's sake. It plays.
Yes, I don't think it is that. Yes, yeah. So Brad Pitt is pretty impressive in this. I also think Bruce Willis is pretty impressive in this, especially at one point he had to go do reshoots for, I guess, Die Hard with a Vengeance, my favorite Die Hard movie, and it had to at one point like totally get back into this headspace, and it was really hard, apparently, according to Gilliam in the Laserdisc commentary, which is also the DVD and Blu-ray commentary, but this movie is from 95, so that's what happened then. And but he talked about how like he was having a hard time moving from John McClane back to Cole, and Gilliam was just like it was having to contend with that. This wasn't him complaining, it was just like this is a thing you have to do when you're acting. And he it's weird because like there are moments where you feel like he's being really underplayed comparatively. I mean, especially compared to like John McClane, but then there's these moments of just pure like childhood joy that he has that really shows that Bruce Willis was willing to go places that Bruce Willis doesn't usually get to go. So that I think is really, really interesting. And Madeline
She
Stowe is
really
also
is,
really good in
yeah.
this too. She apparently was kind of like they made a list of actresses who they were interested in, and they were like her. Like it was like they didn't even like talk to other people. They just looked at it like, oh no, it's
Yeah.
just Madeline Stowe. That's who
Yeah,
it is.
she's
Bam.
completely on
Yeah.
top of it and lights up the screen.
And is really interesting and is like a good audience surrogate.
Because she's questioning, is this guy crazy? I mean, of course he's crazy, but what if he isn't? And is a great stand-in, and is this she psychiatrist, is a rational, educated character. And
Yeah, I also want to before, I have two pieces of casting that I don't know if are necessarily performance. I mean, the performances are good, but I'm not going to say these are the best performances of the movie because of the other three have great ones. But I actually really like that Frank Gorshin is in this movie. There's something really funny about having the Riddler in charge of an insane asylum.
There
There's
is.
something about that. Yeah, just that is really fascinating and a really good choice. And he adds an extra bit of something to the,
yeah,
like an extra
I'm
bit
not
of,
sure exactly what of, it is, but it's definitely something.
Yeah. It's definitely something. I mean, it's not like he's not acting like the Riddler in any way, but you can't help but have that feeling while you're there, even if you don't remember him being the Riddler in the Batman TV show.
Like, yeah, you know, so, he's, yeah, you know, older, you know, more experienced than Madeline Stowe's character here. It's like, okay, he's been doing this for a while, so he's kind of weary a little bit, but you know, is still sure of himself, and that, like you said, adds something. There's a point where Bruce Willis apparently disappears from having been restrained inside a locked room. The restraints are still there, still fastened. The door is still locked, and you know, the way he delivers. You know, he looks up the vent in the ceiling. It's like there's no way he could have done that, and that delivery was really, really good.
And that feels like a really funny Die Hard reference, in my opinion. I'd like, because I don't, that may have been actually in the script. Terry Gilliam said that he was trying his best to not add too much Terryisms to things because he really wanted to just go with the script. The script is from David Peebles and Janet Peebles, who also worked on The Day After Trinity. So they definitely have some experience in this kind of apocalyptic darkness. So he wanted to not put so much Terry Gilliam stuff in it. So, but I do wonder if that like vent thing was in the script proper or was like added to just sort of like,
yeah,
I don't know. Just the Die Hard of it seems too good to. Another thing that is not either here or there, but is cute. Because this would have been 4 years before this movie, I think 4 or 5. At one point, Bruce Willis says, "All I see are dead people."
Yeah. Only a couple of years before. Yeah.
I think that was 99. I think. Yeah. But anyway, so that is if you don't remember, that was a Sixth Sense reference. That movie, 1999, and I just wrote down, "All I see are dead people."
Yep.
Ha! Yeah. Just love it.
Which, wouldn't have played the same way, obviously, when the movie was new, because
it didn't exist yet. But yeah, but you know, as we've discussed, there's some time travel when it comes to Bruce Willis.
Yeah.
So, what is there? Yeah.
So,
okay. Before we move on to other things, I also want to bring up just and this is probably the most Terry Gilliam of the whole thing. It's just the way the movie looks. Some time ago I said a thing about how there's like James Mangold. I don't really know what a James Mangold movie looks like, but then I listed a few directors that I like know, but Terry Gilliam, I know what a Terry Gilliam movie looks like. And this is a pretty classic example, even though this doesn't have like the extra stuff that say,
not as much of it anyway.
Yeah. I mean, it's there, but I mean like Brazil is
that's like wall to wall Gilliam.
Yeah, this is, you know, like he did not write this script. So that kind of, shows something. And so like, but even when he's like in Baltimore, it seems kind of shot like because he's got that wide angle lens on a lot. And so there, even those scenes even still kind of feel like Terry Gilliam, even when like it feels the most Gilliam in the future in 2035, it turns out. Mm-hmm. But
yeah.
But even modern day or like, you know, midnight or 1990s Baltimore still kind of looks like a Terry Gilliam movie. But that may just be because I'm familiar with Fisher King, and Fisher King has a very similar like cityscape use. So
that
could just be that.
I mean, I feel like a different director, you know, could have shot the same scenes in the same, you know, locations, you know, never mind, you know, the sets that were constructed for the movie. But there's a lot of location shooting in this movie. And it's like, a different director could have shot this and it would have been basically the same movie, but looked different because it wasn't Terry Gilliam. There's right. a lot of the way he frames and cuts and pans. That's all here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I like the fact that they have the Baby Jessica riff, which feels more Radio Bart from The Simpsons going on in the background for him.
Yeah.
For her to believe him. Like the whole kid stuck in the whale. That's whale now stuck in the well prank.
Mm-hmm.
Like I like that a lot. Radio Bart, by the way, came out in 1992. But then again, I think I believe this is actually like inspired by the Baby Jessica thing, which was that was also based off of. And then let's see, one other thing. Oh yeah. So I wrote down what came off as the real Python-esque things to me.
Mm-hmm.
And so one of them is them singing Blueberry Hill.
Yeah.
After all together. Like, that was one thing. But then I feel like the way World War One is handled feels like a very Monty Python kind of thing. I don't know. It's just like, we're going to send you to this. And like, oh, you're actually in World War One. Sorry about that.
Oops.
Like, yeah, that not so. I mean, that was in the script because they have the bullet thing for later, obviously. But just like kind of like the way that Gilliam presents that, I was like, this is very enough for something completely different.
Yeah, it was a bit because, okay, you know, you landed in the wrong time the last trip, but we've got that figured out now. So now you're going to land in the right time. And he lands some other time completely. So, yeah, it's kind of like that. I mean, you know, immediately when he does, it's, oh, this is not where he's supposed to be. And it is serious. So it's Python-esque in a way, but, you know, not exactly. It's,
yeah. Yeah. So like those are the big things that I really like in this. I don't know. You got anything else or?
No, not particularly. The mechanic of time travel is deliberately very much like in La Jetée, not very explicit, and that's okay.
It's slightly more explicit, I think, than La Jetée. Because they at least put him into a machine.
Yeah. Yeah. There's some sort of, you know, electromechanical technology involved here for sure. There's no question. They don't really go into a whole lot of detail, and that's okay.
Yeah.
But I do really like that, you know, the script has really, really thought out, you know, the causality and, you know, what follows what or, you know, causes what, and the way this twists back on itself and is a very, very solid closed loop.
Yeah. I think the smartest thing is the first time he goes back, we don't see how he did it. He just is suddenly in 1990.
Yeah, that's basically just a jump cut.
Yeah, and then the second time we actually do see him like going into the machine and getting prepared and stuff.
At least a little bit.
And I think that's actually kind of the more interesting way of doing it. I mean, you know, no offense to, you know, it wouldn't have worked in like, say, Back to the Future.
No.
But I think show it like keeping us from knowing how it's done at first actually allows us to buy into it a little bit quicker, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Like we get invested in the story in a different way. But I do think it causes us, the audience, to latch on to Cole in that time a lot quicker because of it.
Yeah. And it preserves some of the element of mystery. Like, you know, we, the audience, are still not really sure what's going on here in the same way that Cole is not, where he's questioning his sanity and, you know, did I come from the future? Is, you know, this the present, or is this my past? And, you know, we, the audience, don't really know either for a little bit. It's, you know, kind of deliberately ambiguous for a bit, at least.
All right, so what aren't the good times?
This is October, right?
April.
What year is this?
What year do you think it is?
1996.
That's the future, James. Do you think you're living in the future?
1996 is the past.
No, 1996 is the future. This is 1990.
What aren't the good times? So some of the particularly Gilliam bits felt kind of non sequitur-ish to me, honestly. Like,
I can see that.
Yeah,
I can see that.
Like, not quite of a piece. Mm-hmm. Like this, you know, the bit where they sing, you know, Blueberry Hill with the backdrop of the you know, the painting in the frame and everything. It's like that kind of felt like maybe it belonged in a different movie. Honestly,
no, I can believe. I like it. I don't think you're wrong.
But yeah. I didn't remember that from the last time I saw this movie. Really, that's about it, to be honest.
The only thing I have a few questionable things.
Okay. Okay. Shoot.
Like, one is Plummer's accent, because like, it's fine for what it is, but it also seems unnecessary.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, I felt like it was right at the edge without ever being completely over the top.
Mm-hmm.
But it was like right there. It's like, on the edge of caricature.
Yeah. Interesting, you know, little tidbit. So in Amanda Plummer, his daughter, is in The Fisher King, so the previous film. Mm-hmm. So that's fun. And then I don't really know if this is this isn't really good or bad. It's just, this is kind of an observer that, you know, your mileage could vary on this. An observation, I mean. So, like, the violence in this, despite, like, compared to, like, Looper, feels grittier despite there not being as much gun violence. It's because, I mean, there is gun violence, but it's less heightened, especially compared to Looper, and which, I mean, it was the movie we watched before this. Not like anyone else would compare the two of them regularly, but the hand-to-hand stuff, the physical violence that occurs is a lot grittier, I feel. But it's the reason why I bring this, it's interesting because that doesn't feel Die Hard-esque, like, because, you know, John McClane usually shot things. I mean, like, he fought, you know, too, but until he had a machine gun. Yeah. And to be honest, there was a couple of moments I was like, ho, now I have a spider. no, kidding. And so I don't know, this isn't really here or there for me. Like, I think it's just something that I noticed this time, but I think it's telling me more about Looper than it is telling me about 12 Monkeys. I don't know, that's not really good or bad, but it wasn't exactly great, so that's why I kind of chose to talk about it here. But other than that, like, pretty much this all works for me, although I'm not 100% on board with the Stockholm Syndrome stuff that Madeline Stowe's character might be going through. I can kind of get in with her getting on his side. I can get with that. But them having, like, romantic stuff seemingly starting to blossom towards the end, that kind of bothers me. That's about it there. I can kind of get on board with her, believing him and following through and helping him out there. I can kind of get to that. But when they, like, kiss at the end, I'm like, I think we went a little too far here. It is a movie from 1995. Which is a thing would do, like, what you would do then. Sure. And so, like, it's like, and it's like the kiss at the end of the third Star Wars movie. Like, it's like, we didn't need it.
Like, I don't know. That didn't really bother me here at all. Like, it wasn't, you know, Stockholm Syndrome exactly, because
I don't want to call it that, because it's not exactly
that. But it's a little more akin, because, you know, their relationship started out as, you know, doctor and patient. Here's a callback to Back to the Future, Florence Nightingale effect, where it's like, so she wants to help this guy because she can see that, you know, he's troubled and believes that she can, because this is actually a thing that's her field and kind of falls for her patient. He does later. And so
that's, I don't know. This is splitting hairs over things.
It is.
Either way, the APA would be mad.
Yeah.
So, like, I don't know. That's the only thing that, like, I kind of have, like, and that's a script thing. That's not a Madeline Stowe thing. That's that's the only thing that I kind of, like, But other than that, I think this has very few faults, and that's pretty great. All right. Is it time to overthink?
I guess it must be.
Okay.
Then it was my idea about the virus. We were in the institution. It was all fuzzy with the drugs and all. You think it was my idea? You think maybe I wiped out the human race?
Nobody is gonna wipe out the human race. Not you or Jeffrey or anybody else.
So I don't. So a thing I want you to kind of expand on, because you're the bigger sci-fi geek of us, is the concept of. So this is a time loop film. This is a closed time loop.
Yes.
Is what we would call this. Whereas, like, say, Looper would have been, I guess, an open time loop had we seen more of them.
Yeah.
But because we only really see, like, one and a half. This counts as a closed time loop. But it is also, because it's a closed time loop, there's a certain variety of paradox to it that requires it to work. And there you go, Tim.
Okay. So, yeah, there's... So the two kinds of paradoxes you hear about most often, and we've talked about them already, are, you know, the grandfather paradox, which, you know, you get a classic example of in Back to the Future.
Nasty in the pasty.
Right, yes. And also the bootstrap paradox, where, you know, past self only knows something because future self told him, and future self knows because he aged from past self. It's like, where did that actually come from? This is kind of both a little bit in the formation of the loop, the causality of it. So in attempting to they're convinced they can't actually change what has already happened. It has happened. This virus has gotten out, and the population is all but wiped out. Okay, that's happened, that's fixed. But by trying to make things better going forward and using time travel to do so, they sort of create what happened in the past. The past causes the future, but the future also causes the past.
Yeah,
So,
or
yeah.
so it seems to Bruce Willis's
Yeah.
perception,
Yeah.
because he brings up the Army of the 12 Monkeys thing to Brad Pitt when they're in their institution together. And so, but there isn't anything that also claims that it could have happened anyway. Like, it could have been that, like,
Yeah.
it could be that,
Yeah, there's
Bruce Willis could just have been there or not, and he still could have come up with the whole 12 Monkey thing.
it's possible.
But that's not really given to us, is what I'm is
It's not. And so, okay, because we're overthinking, we do need to get into spoiler territory here.
Again, you're supposed to watch the movie before you listen to this, period.
Yep,
So
yep.
yeah.
We warned you in the last episode we were going to be talking about this movie. 30-year-old movie, statute of limitations is well past. So, the Army of the 12 Monkeys isn't, in fact, the real threat. Bruce Willis does not discover this until the end of the movie. The real threat is this other guy who's like this apocalyptic doomsayer, and is the human race is the disease, and to cure it we need to kill them all kind of stuff. And we hear him at a couple of points during the movie talking about that, so that is set up, but it's a kind of blink and you miss it. Unless you're really paying attention, you're gonna just wave your hand and write that off. But he totally still could have done those things. However, there's also, Christopher Plummer changed his plans and how that all plays out. So this guy who actually is responsible for the virus had access
David
that,
Morse.
yeah, David Morse, who is also really good here, even though it's a small part.
Very blonde.
Yeah, yeah. It's entirely possible he still could have done this very much as he did. So there's a little bit of, fuzzy, blurry something going on in that space-time around him here. So maybe this would have happened anyway, but
Well, it depends on because they're kind of because they get into the whole 12 monkey thing because they find the thing that says we did it. And so the future people
And
and
also the spray paint that it turns out, Madeline Stowe put on their headquarters.
But that was later though, was it? Like we don't have that at the very beginning.
We don't have that at the beginning because it's at the end of the movie where we see her doing that, but Bruce Willis did have that much
We're
earlier
assuming it's
on.
there.
Yeah, that was referenced, that along with the voicemail message and a couple of other things. It's like, okay,
And that's
this
the
leads us to
bootstrap
think, yeah,
part of this.
yeah, yeah. Leads us to think the 12 monkeys are responsible for this, and that's why we're looking for them. And so yeah, that was set up earlier in the movie, not right at the very beginning, I don't think, but a little bit after.
Well, because he finds the 12 monkeys thing when he volunteers to go out, quote unquote volunteers, and and the animals are still out and about apparently. So this is 40 years into the future apparently, which by the way I have problems with that math. The and this is this that's part of my overthink is so I don't think we're told 2035 in the movie proper. It's
No,
only
I
in the
don't think
promotional
so.
stuff.
Yeah.
Because when I read the back of the box the first time, I was like, oh, this is the 20. That doesn't seem right.
Yeah,
Because if he's
it's
8 years old in 1995,
or
he's sub
96,
or 96. Oh, yeah, 99. So this kid, so he's like 47
ish. Yeah.
ish. I mean, he didn't get a lot of sun, so they would age differently, but they're also not getting the best nutrition either. So, I don't know. Like, cause, and Bruce is like 40 when this movie comes out, and so like I have a hard time buying this. And so it's like I if it 2030 I'd be more willing to believe, but I think if it was 2025, like right now, like I think that makes more sense time wise. But like I said, it's not in the script or it's not stated in the script at any point, so
Yeah,
I don't
at
know.
least not in anything that I remember being in the finished cut of the movie. It's some little while, some few decades into the future, where Bruce Willis is older but not old.
I'm not sure the Lions would have kept up in Baltimore 20 or 40 years down the line either.
Well, yeah, some of those animals probably wouldn't. Not with the seasonality like that.
Yeah, exactly. That's
lions in their native habitat. They don't get winters like that.
Nope.
I don't know. Would they have adapted in a few decades? Yeah, not.
I don't know.
Not that much, probably.
I mean, these were zoo animals.
They were. So yeah. I don't know.
Yeah.
At least 40 years ago they were.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, those are not the same ones. And then again, who knows about that bear? Like that bear that could have been a zoo bear, but that also could have just been a bear.
Yeah.
At that point of things. So it's one of those things where like I can be fine with like time is fixed. We can't change it. Like we can't save humanity from this, but we can potentially cure the virus for us to go above ground again.
Mm-hmm.
I can kind of get behind that. Like that is fine. But yeah, the whole like him seeing his own death and it having to be like that is kind of like, I don't know, like when it's a closed loop like this and there is no like this is a movie that very much believes in fate to
it. Like, really, really does. It's like this is all immutable. There is no changing.
Yeah, there is no changing it. But it does make you wonder like how much of this like adjusts, like, like if anything different happens or
like anything at all.
Yeah. And yeah, so I don't know.
I don't either, but like I said, I like that it's well thought out. They closed off all the loose ends really that we can see. So
so Cole has a bummer of an end. That's a for sure thing.
Really, really does.
Yeah, but how do we feel about where humanity might be going? Because we both before we were recording, we were talking about this.
So. Yeah, we're definitely talking about this. So La Jetée at least is hopeful. For that, it sounds like, okay, I mean, it's going to take, time and a lot of work, but they, achieve the means to get there. In 12 Monkeys, it's a lot more ambiguous.
Totally.
It's okay. So we get to the end of the movie and we see that, people from, Bruce Willis's time, at some point in the nebulous future, are still observing and are still able to send people back. There's this other guy, Jose, who catches up with Bruce Willis at a few different points, catches up with him right before the end of the movie. It's like, oh, they've learned some other stuff.
And, here's a gun.
Yep. And then at the very end, we see one of the scientists from the future on the plane,
which I did not catch. So you had to tell me this.
Yeah, I didn't catch it the first time. Either, and the only reason I caught it this time was because she was named. It's like this is the person speaking in the captions because I had to turn on the captions.
The thing is, I had the subtitles on and they didn't do this.
Yeah,
so
that's a little weird, but
yeah, depends on where you're getting from, I guess.
I guess so there's the possibility. It's not a certainty within the bounds of the movie's runtime that things are going to work out. Post 2035 or whenever it is, that things will get better after that. They could, maybe. We don't really know, and that's not really exactly the story this movie is telling.
No, this is the story of Cole and his time travel in order to do things. And then along the way, he meets a woman, very much like our character in La Jetée, and wants to spend more time. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, makes sense.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Tim, what about the butterflies?
There basically aren't any.
That's what I thought too.
Yeah, which ties into what I've been saying.
I mean,
this whole episode.
There's the little things that we were talking about. Yeah. But I don't think those quite qualify here.
No, because things are not drastically altered. It's not like somebody stepped on a butterfly in the mud and now everything is inexplicably different because of knock on chain of events effects. This is all very, very, tightly tied up.
Yeah. It's very smart scripting.
Yeah. Very, very narrowly focused and is better for it, but is still very thought provoking.
Yeah. All right. Time to leave.
Yeah.
Bunch of weirdos let all the animals out of the zoo. And they locked up this big shot scientist in one of the cages. Scientist's own kid, one of the ones, did it. Now they got animals all over the place.
Yeah. So what would your grade be for this?
So this one's tough for me, honestly. Mm-hmm. There's, like I said, there's a lot to like here. There's very little that doesn't work. It's so well crafted and, you know, mm-hmm. great performances. I want to say A minus, mm-hmm. just because, you know, this is still kind of, you know, this is not a knock on it being a lower budget, you know, not a big budget blockbuster, you know, mm-hmm. you know,
most money Terry Gilliam had,
imaginative special effects. It says this is not an effects heavy movie, and I'm not knocking it for that. This is still kind of, you know, deliberately a smaller movie.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I think this is kind of my personal baggage. Like I sort of felt like it should have been bigger for some reason, even though that doesn't make any sense. I like it for what it is. It's not something mm-hmm. I'm going to revisit frequently because it is a downer. Boy, is it a downer, like a lot of other Gilliam joints. So I'm going to say A-.
Okay. Yeah, I'm actually with you on A-. When I saw this when I was like 11 or 12, like it has gone up in my summation, but because I think when I was 11 or 12, I would have called it like a B+ movie, because I enjoyed it. I think I would have been a little bummed out by the ending, but I also would have been like a blown my mind kind mm-hmm, of ending mm-hmm. when I was 11. But you know, now I actually enjoy the little bits of it more. Like, and the special effects I think are actually harder for us to see.
Yeah.
It's kind of like a David Fincher thing where where a surprising amount of stuff in David Fincher movies are computer graphics. like, I think it's things like that kind of are going on here. Like the giraffes are CG, the flamingos are CG, yeah, all the other animals are actual animals. I mean, they do like mat in the lion onto the building at one point, but that's an actual lion, mm-hmm. you know, things like that. So I think, but I think it's more production design than special effects in a lot of ways.
Yeah, yeah. Like there's not a lot of, you know, flashy light show around the time travel at all.
Right. Yeah, yeah, totally. And even in like the time travel is just sort of like, put him in a thing. Mm-hmm. Like that's it.
Yeah, and then we cut to, oh, there he is.
Yeah.
Like we don't see him appearing. He's just there.
Yeah. And that's the thing. It's that we don't see him blip out or anything, mm-hmm. but I imagine it's just like what happens in Looper. Just
pretty much
suddenly there, suddenly gone.
Yeah.
Yep. But yeah, I'm with you. A- on that. I think one of my favorite things about this movie is that this is the first film to get to use the phrase inspired by, because I guess the guild didn't usually let you do that. I think in the 30s, they would use a phrase called, well, actually we used it for Simon Birch, but like the phrase suggested by was once used, and I'm actually kind of surprised that wasn't used here, but inspired by does feel a little bit closer than say suggested by, because there are definitely elements that are being reused here. Gilliam for his Gilliam's actively tried to not watch Le Jeté, to not borrow from it at all, but the Vertigo stuff still kind of shows up, the tree stuff shows up again via Vertigo, which I found pretty interesting.
Yeah.
But yeah, I don't think this is his best movie. I actually really like Brazil. Brazil's depressing, but but it's not. Whereas I think like my other favorite movie of his is Time Bandits, which we could have done here, but you know, it made more sense to go with this instead.
Hey, summer's not over. We may still get
summer's.
There.
This is true. Maybe. Summer's not over we'll yet. See. Maybe. And so it's interesting to me that this is, you know, one of his kind of like well-known but still kind of undersung movies. It's part of America trilogy that, you know, I don't know we talk about as much as his Imagination trilogy. So that's, I don't know, I think this is a little undersung for Terry Gilliam. Even though I guess it did have a TV show, so maybe I'm
yeah,
wrong there,
and but, the and the TV yeah. show is like 10 years old at this point.
Exactly. So. I don't know. Like, it's not as good as Brazil. I am more likely to watch Brazil and Time Bandits before I'd watch this again, but I would watch this before I'd watch Baron Munchausen again, I guess.
Yeah.
But that's more Andrew than anything else.
Yeah. And I'm kind of the other way. Like, you know, yeah. Munchausen is like tinged with a sort of nostalgia and melancholy mm-hmm. to it. But I mean, man, Brazil is depressing. It's like, yeah, it's a better crafted movie, I can't argue that, and I'm not trying to, but yeesh.
No, I get that. Yeah, and you haven't seen Tideland,
That's
so
true. I haven't.
you want to talk about depressing? Yeah. Oh man. Oh man. All right. Sorry, that is 12 Monkeys, and we will be sticking with time loops, right, Tim?
Yeah. There,
We'll loop back.
believe it or not, there are a few more of them. We are going to next time go with the really quintessential time loop movie. This is a really, really small indie film, Primer.
Yes, this is the brain-breaking time loop movie, from what I understand. So
It really, really is.
I may have to watch it more than once, which annoys me, but I'm okay with that. This one I have not seen. You have,
I
so
have.
you'll get to be the expert this time.
It's been a
So,
little while, but yeah. But
yep.
that'll be next time. For right now, that's our show. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time. Bye.
Bye.
The movie never changes. It doesn't change, but every time you see it, it seems different because you're different.